Moncrief on News Talk.
Being a rather secretive and conservative Catholic organisation, Opus Dei fitted the bill perfectly when Dan Brown was looking for baddies for his book The Da Vinci Code. But the real-life organisation may also have some activities it would rather we didn't know about. At least that's the view of Gareth Gore, the author of Opus, Dark Money, A Secretive Cult and Its Mission to Remake Our World. Good afternoon, Gareth.
Hello there, Sean.
So to start at the beginning, José María Escrivá, tell us about him. Who was he prior to setting up Opus Dei?
So José María Escrivá was a Spanish priest who in 1928 went on retreat. And after that day, he told everybody that he had basically received a vision from God, outlining the basis for a new organization that would help ordinary Catholics to live out their faith more seriously, without needing to become priests or nuns. But very quickly, that kind of quite benign vision began to evolve into something altogether more political and more and dark, to be honest.
So in its early days, what kind of work did it do, or how did it interact with its members?
Well, in the early days, Escrivá actually found it very difficult to recruit members. And what he did was he devised this blueprint for collecting information on potential recruits and working out the best way of targeting them. I mean, this was he was ahead of his time in some ways. He was a cult leader who was developing these practices that today are common to almost every other cult, whether it be Scientology or whatever. He was developing them on his own, working out ways of targeting these young men and young women and drawing them into this movement.
Yeah, and where would he target them? Was this within, say, third-level institutions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, and so, I mean, Opus Dei, right from its start, and this is still true today, kind of operates in a very covert way. So Escrivá set up this a series of university residences across Spain in the 1930s and 1940s. And in fact, Opus Dei still does this very same thing. It operates these university residences in places like Dublin, in London, and all around the world, where they, I guess, offer accommodation to students. But what they're doing is, you know, they're inviting these people in, they usually have an interview, and they're working out whether these people are potential recruits. And they're monitoring them, they're collecting information on them, and they're using kind of pastoral guidance sessions and spiritual guidance sessions to hone their recruitment methods and to really kind of groom these people into joining the organization.
And when they would join the organization, would they still work in the outside world and make a living?
So generally, yes. So, the whole idea of Opus Dei, or the idea that Opus Dei sells to the world, is that you as an ordinary Catholic can be more serious about your faith without becoming a priest or a nun. You can basically offer up your daily life, whether you know you're a student or a doctor or a homemaker or whatever you might be, by striving for perfection. That's the way of kind of serving God more deeply. So yes, I mean, and usually when people are recruited into the movement, when they're recruited to become a numerary member, which is a celibate member who dedicates their life to Opus Dei, yeah, you're generally expected to carry on doing whatever you're doing, whether you're an engineer or a doctor or a journalist. But often over time, as the demands of the organization kind of shift and they might need you to move to another city or take up an internal job, the requirements of the organization take over. And so, you know, the individual career or even, you know, your wants and desires, they take a very much a secondary role. I mean, I should also add that there are other types of members. So these numeraries, the celibate members, are about 10% of the membership. Most members are what they call supernumeraries. So they are usually married people who live at home with their spouse and often have kids and live normal lives. But, you know, they're also kind of subject to this kind of monitoring and kind of manipulation.
Yeah. Are they required to contribute money to Opus Dei?
Yes, absolutely. So the numerary celibate members are expected to give all of their earnings to Opus Dei. And they live in these gender segregated centers where every movement, every moment of their life is basically controlled and monitored. The supernumeraries are also expected to contribute money to Opus Dei. They're told to consider Opus Dei as an extra child. And so if you have 3-4 kids, then, you know, Opus Dei is your 6th kid. And you should expect to donate to Opus Dei the equivalent amount that you might spend on your child.
So in Spain, and this was during the era of fascist Spain, how did they ingratiate themselves with the authorities in Spain at the time?
Well, I mean, so right from the start, Opus Dei has been an extremely kind of politically minded organization. So it's always presented to the world this facade of, we just want to help ordinary Catholics. But we now know, thanks to hundreds of pages of internal documents that were smuggled out of Opus Dei by former members, that there was a hidden agenda. And you know, the main aim right since the 1930s and very much today has always been to infiltrate the elite of society, so the wealthy and the powerful. Escrivá saw his followers as this hidden army who would infiltrate every part of society, whether it's journalism or government, the judiciary, and use the situations there to benefit the movement in some way and push forward its agenda. And it very much did that during Franco Spain. So, you know, in the 1940s, Opus Dei basically managed to take over a number of states. Enterprises and siphoned off huge amounts of money to finance its expansion across Spain and around the world. But in addition to that, it was also very much in bed with General Franco. You know, the Franco invited the leader of Opus Dei to give him a private 6-day retreat at the palace where he lived in northern Madrid, and Franco offered all kinds of financial and operational help to Opus Dei, and so successful was Opus Dei in penetrating the kind of Spanish elite that at one stage in the 50s. Opus Dei actually approached Franco and kind of offered itself as and offered its services to penetrate the working classes as well. I mean, Franco decided not to take up the offer, but it shows you just how much the organization was in bed with this murderous regime.
Then in the mid-50s, and this is one of the more dramatic claims in your book, Banco Popular, they effectively took it over. How did they go about doing that?
Yes, absolutely. So a group of numerary men in Madrid, they found out some compromising information about the chairman of a national bank. And they used that information to muscle their way in, to push this guy out and to take over the bank. And since the 1950s, and you know, the book goes into great detail about how this was done and how they then abused their positions within the bank to benefit Opus Dei, they basically turned this national bank into a cash machine for Opus Dei, which then went on to finance the expansion of the movement to every corner of the globe. I mean, it's pretty hard to put precise figures on it, but we know for certain that hundreds of millions of euros were siphoned from the bank. And I think it's probably more like billions of euros.
Right. Now, was this in the form of loans, or were they, was this extortion? Was what they were doing illegal?
I think what they were doing was largely followed the letter of the law. Whether it followed the spirit of the law is another question entirely. So this money was, there were loans, yes. There were also kind of donations made by the bank to various Opus Dei initiatives. But also the chairman of the bank, who was a numerary member of Opus Dei, one of these celibate members, he used his position there to effectively carve out a bunch of extremely valuable assets that once belonged to the bank and effectively kind of give over control to Opus Dei. So for many years, the Banco Popular headquarters was actually owned by a number of Opus Dei foundations, and the bank itself had to pay rent to these foundations in order to carry on doing business there.
Parallel to this, my impression is that within the Vatican, there was certainly at senior levels, there was a certain amount of nervousness about Opus Dei until John Paul II came along.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, under John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, there was a deep suspicion about Opus Dei. And in fact, at one stage, Paul the 6th considered launching a Vatican inquiry into alleged spying that Opus Dei was doing against the Vatican and the way that it was, I guess, abusing its position within the church. And there was a huge kind of standoff between Escrivá and Paul VI. But yeah, I mean, the election of John Paul II, which was a big surprise. I mean, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, I mean, John Paul I was elected in 1978. He was found dead in his bed like 30 days later. And then all the cardinals had to come back to Rome to vote again. And they really struggled to come up with a candidate. And so this archbishop from Krakow, Wojtyła, he was elected pope, but only after about 7 or 8 rounds of voting. What I think many of the cardinals didn't know was just how close John Paul II was to Opus Dei. So they'd kind of been grooming him and had a very strong relationship with him right through the 60s and 70s. And in fact, one of his very first meetings after being elected as Pope was he invited the leader of Opus Dei to come in, and his first words were, "This is not a papal audience, this is a family meeting." And yes, and that so the election of John Paul II, a real ally of Opus Dei, really transformed the movement's prospects. So John Paul II very quickly moved to do 2 critical things. One was to grant Opus Dei this special status within the church that no organization before or since has ever had, the status of personal prelature. And what that did was effectively allow Opus Dei to operate anywhere in the world outside of the normal hierarchy of the church. So there was no accountability. It was allowed to do whatever it wanted, basically, anywhere it wanted in the world. And the second thing was that John Paul II rushed through the beatification and canonization of the Opus Dei founder, José María Escrivá. So he's now known as Saint José María, the saint of ordinary life. And what that did, what those 2 things did was really, I guess, set a rocket under its ability to expand and recruit, because it could do that outside the hierarchy of the church, didn't have to answer to any local bishop or archbishop. And also, it approached ordinary Catholics saying, look, the leader of Opus Dei is a saint. And so, you know, obviously, that was something that drew ordinary Catholics in.
And can Opus Dei now does it have its own priests?
Yes. So Opus Dei, so what normally happens is, Opus Dei recruits young men into the movement and encourages them to become numeraries, these celibate members. And then after a number of years, and it tells them that they're going to be able to carry on in their current careers, whether that's a journalist or doctor or teacher, whatever it might be. But then at some point, I guess after they've been monitored for a certain amount of time and Opus Dei is happy with them and I guess their political outlook and their spiritual outlook, then these men receive a tap on the shoulder and they're basically told, you're going to become a priest. And they're sent to Rome and they're trained as priests. So Opus Dei currently has about 2,000 priests around the world. Some of them are kind of stationed at Opus Dei residences, but others are, you know, in everyday parishes. And, you know, there may well be many parishes in Ireland and around the world where, you know, the local congregants have no clue that their local priest is an Opus Dei member.
Well, there's at least one parish in Ireland that's actually run by Opus Dei. It's on actually a part of a rather well-to-do part of Dublin.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, Ireland has been a primary target of Opus Dei right from the 40s. You know, because of its obvious, you know, its Catholic links. Apologies if I don't pronounce this correctly. The Cloak's Quay area of Dublin. They operate this. They have a university residence there called the Glenard University Residence, which is a student dorm for girls, affiliated, I guess, to the University College Dublin. And you know, it's you know, they have these presences all in every kind of major city all around the world. But yeah, absolutely in Ireland.
Another extraordinary allegation in your book is about the use of young women who are recruited, and then it seems it's virtual indentured servitude. Now, as I understand it, in Argentina, prosecutors have made a formal accusation just last month on this matter. So what's going on there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So as I was saying earlier, so Opus Dei has always targeted the elite of society because what they want to do is influence society. And to do that, you need to target the wealthy and the powerful. But in order to kind of run all of these residences all around the world, the residences for Numeri members, but also the student residences where it's recruiting tomorrow's elite, it needs domestic workers. And Escrivá came up with this great idea, what he thought was a great idea in the 1940s, which was to effectively recruit the women who were working in the centers as cooks and cleaners, to recruit them as Numeris as well. And as part of them joining Opus Dei, they were expected to hand their wages back. So Opus Dei was giving them their money with the one hand and then taking it back with the other. And actually, in later years, they decided to skip that entirely and just stop paying the women. But yes, I mean, you're talking about this case in Argentina. So this has been going on for a few years now. In about, I think it was 2021, a group of 42 women came forward and filed an official complaint with the Vatican, alleging that they'd been recruited as young girls, as, you know, the ages of 12, 13, into Opus Dei. So what had happened was these Opus Dei numeris had gone to these very poor villages in northern Argentina, neighboring Paraguay and Bolivia, and they'd gone door to door with an Opus Dei priest. And they'd basically told the families, hey, you know, your girls here, there are no prospects here. Why don't you send them back to this school that we're running in Buenos Aires? We'll teach them, and we'll give them all these qualifications, and you know, they'll have a much better life. They can aim for a great job in the hospitality industry. Now, once these girls were hundreds of miles from their families, and we're talking here 12, 13-year-olds, they were coerced and manipulated into joining Opus Dei as what they call these numeri servants or numeri assistants that they're sometimes called today. And, you know, three weeks ago, after a two-year-long investigation, federal prosecutors in Argentina decided to file formal accusations against Opus Dei for human trafficking. So these girls were recruited in places like Argentina, and then they were shipped to wherever they were needed by Opus Dei around the world. Now, I know from my reporting that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think this is possibly the next big scandal to hit the church or to hit Opus Dei. I mean, because this is a very Opus Dei specific phenomenon. I know that the Banco Popular financed dozens of these schools all around the world, including in Ireland. But we know from, you know, the Financial Times put out an excellent piece, a journalist called Antonia Cundy, earlier this year, where she met many of these women who were recruited to become numeri servants, numeri assistants in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, they basically lived in an annex of the stable yard and in the basement, and they were, you know, effectively providing free labor to Opus Dei for the Opus Dei members who were coming there for the retreats and for the conferences that were held there. So yeah, this is not something I think that's unique to Argentina. I think very similar things were happening all around the world. These young girls being recruited into this life of servitude, effectively, and then trafficked around the world.
Now, obviously, the also I suppose part of the mission, if it's not a mission statement, but to be politically influential as well. And you do relate in the book how everyone assumes Donald Trump got elected and then the political makeup of the Supreme Court changed. Tell us, who is Leonard Leo and how does that intersect with Opus Dei?
So, I mean, ever since the 30s, Opus Dei has always sought to, you know, penetrate the elite, because that's how you change society. And Escrivá, what he wanted to do was, and he never told this to the wider public, but, you know, we know this thanks to these secret documents that we've now got hold of. He wanted a complete, what he called, re-Christianization of society. And so it's no accident that, you know, today in Washington, D.C., Opus Dei has a real sizable presence. About 800 people in the wider D.C. area belong to Opus Dei, and many, many more kind of attend Opus Dei and get kind of guidance from it, attend its events. So one, you know, it's incredible. You look at the people around Trump, and so many of them are linked to Opus Dei in some way. So you have Leonard Leo. So officially, he's not a member of Opus Dei, but he's certainly very well connected to the organization. So he's a regular at this place called the Catholic Information Center, which is basically the Opus Dei hub in central Washington. There's a blue plaque on the door outside, which boasts how it's the closest tabernacle to the White House, which tells you all you need to know about Opus Dei's kind of ambitions and intentions. It's all about proximity to power. So Leonard Leo is a board member there, and previous board members have included the former Attorney General Bill Barr, Pat Cipollone, who was the White House chief counsel under Donald Trump. So Leonard Leo, yeah, I mean, absolutely. He's I guess the guy credited with the conservative stroke Catholic takeover of the US Supreme Court, which, as I'm sure all your listeners will know, is responsible for having overturned Roe v. Wade in the last couple of years.
Indeed, it's fascinating stuff. I should point out, though, that Opus Dei, of course, deny every single syllable of seemingly what's written in Garrett's book. That book is called Opus Dark Money, A Secretive Cult and Its Mission to Remake Our World. Gareth Gore, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean, for having me on.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.